Well, let's start with what is your musical background?
So my musical background, well, my parents are in show business. My mother is a singer, and my father is a choreographer. And, I spent much of my younger years traveling the world in this kind of gypsy band of performers, and was shoved in front of a piano before I could speak. So that is my earliest background. Then later, obviously, through much traveling, I was exposed to a lot of world music, which I think still to this day influences a lot of my writing and opened me up to just the curiosity of the variety of colors that are out there. My parents were both musicians, and my mother's a singer.
So what was it that inspired you to write film and TV music?
I was really drawn to writing for symphonic ensembles when I was young, and wanted to write symphonies. Now, at 17, getting commissioned to write a symphony is a bit of a difficult concept. Mm-hmm. And next best thing was to come and score movies, which is still one of the last places where you can hear your music played by glorious ensembles of musicians long before you're dead. So hence my move to Los Angeles.
So what is the first thing you do when you begin to write a score?
Probably for me, the most important aspect of scoring a movie or a TV show or even a commercial or any kind of project is determining a unique palette of colors, something which will give a musical aura, if you will, to the project in a way that is unique and unto itself. I do that generally by picking out instrumentation. And even if it's a symphonic score, I will still try to figure out what part of the orchestra I will emphasize more than others, if it's more of a brass score, or if it's more of a woodwind score, more of a string score, or if I will literally not write for woodwinds at all and just keep it to only strings and harp, say. These days, I've gotten to write more and more electronic music, so it becomes an interesting prospect of picking among millions of possible combinations of sounds and trying to find things that are unique to that particular project. The use of ethnic instruments in maybe out of context can be very interesting, because it can give colors that are altogether very original to each project. So I would say that probably picking a palette, restricting the palette to a few shades that will make that score unique. Harmony also can help determine that. Very triadic music versus more avant-garde kind of chord structures can give very unique, to this idea of something that is particular to a project.
Well, now you have done a bit of work for both the TV and movies and video games as well. What do you find are the differences between writing for, let's say, TV as opposed to movies?
Mainly because of the length of an hourly episodic movie versus, which tends to be around the 43 to 46 minute mark, versus a film, which will, be closer to 90 to 100 minutes. The sense of pacing that is very different in creating an arc. A film score is a combination of many little cues that occur every few minutes or closer together, but there is we write with the thought of the need of each scene, obviously as the cue pertains to each moment, whether it's a chase cue, a romantic moment, taking an arc and taking the audience from the prologue to the epilogue of a project. And the pacing of a two-hour project is very different in how one approaches even the spotting. There's many longer cues in a feature film than there are in a TV film. The same thing can be said about a 90-second trailer, many of which I've done. There's a certain way of developing the arc of the emotional content and following that. And I think that it's governed by also the way screenwriters are used to telling a story in a 46-minute format versus a 120-minute format.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned a few times that you've worked on trailers. And you kind of mentioned this, 46-minute format. How do you get across your music in, 90 seconds?
That's the thing that's interesting about a trailer, actually, because it is a mini-movie. In fact, many trailers are unique. They're very different even in commercials, because they're not just trying to sell a product. I mean, they are, obviously, they're trying to get you to the theater to see the movie, but mm-hmm. they're also trying to tell you a little mini movie in anywhere from 60 to 120 seconds. And so, interestingly enough, even in that short of a time span, there is still fairly common beats. There is the little introduction that follows then the intrigue that follows the development of the story, maybe for only 30 seconds each, and then the grand montage leading to the climax, which usually results in the big card, you know, the title card of the film. And then there's always a little aftermath, there's a little tag at the end. Mm-hmm. And so they all have a certain recipe, and part of being a composer is also understanding that there's a creative side to what I do, but there's also a functional side to what I do. I have to help all the members of the team, whether the editor, the writer, the director, or even sometimes the actress, continue to tell the story. We're all trying to, we have a common goal in mind, which is to get something across to an audience. Mm-hmm. And that's true of 120 seconds as well as 120 minutes.
All right, so now you also listed as composing additional music for particular films. How closely do you work with the other composer, or are you brought in as sort of an afterthought?
I've actually only composed additional music once.
Oh, okay.
And I might be listed as additional composer only because people might have licensed my music here and there on different projects. So I've never collaborated as a hired composer, per se, on more than one movie. And the reason why, and it was on a Leslie Nielsen film directed by Pat Proft.
Is it Wrongly Accused, I think?
Wrongfully Accused,
yes.
Thank you. And the reason why I was involved in that project is that Pat, the beginning of the film opens up with Leslie Nielsen playing a symphonic, violin concerto with a symphony orchestra where, you know, he gets the bow caught in the violin and it flies across and stabs somebody in the eye and then he falls in the timpani and whatever. There was all sorts of skits around the performance of this grand violin solo. And so it needed to be scored fairly tightly with his skit. So they hired me actually to do what's called a pre-record, where we went and I met with them for over the course of a few weeks in pre-production, and we discussed the chronology of the skits, the timing of each section, and then I wrote a symphonic piece based on a Verdi Requiem around the choreography of Leslie's skit. Mm-hmm. We recorded that piece. They then shot the skit to what I'd written. And the composer who eventually did the score was hired months after I was ever involved in the project in the post-production stage to actually score the film.
All right. Now, some of your earliest work was with Roger Corman. So how did you come to work with Roger Corman?
Ah, good old Roger. Yes, we owe him. We all owe him so much. Actually, I did not really come to work with Roger Corman. I got hired by a director called Bert Dragon to work on a movie that Roger Corman had purchased or was distributing at the time.
Okay.
So I didn't actually work closely with him in any way. The closest I got to him was that he threatened to fire me because he found out that I had spent too much of my budget on hiring a recording studio.
Ah.
So it was one of the humorous things. It was one of my first films, and I was very excited about putting all of the budget towards having the best possible sound and not really caring much if I had a profit in the end. And apparently when he found out what studio I was recording, he was very upset that, you know, he felt that it was just such a waste of money. So the closest I got to him was to get fired for spending too much of my own money on his film.
Well, how closely do you work with the director on a specific film, or are you just told, just go compose and come back to me?
Oh, no. I work as closely to the director as the director wants to work with me, and that is often determined by how much time they are able to spend in post-production, which more often than not is quite a bit. Now, on a TV project, the director is not at all involved, and he is replaced generally in his position by the executive producer, who is more of the creative overseer of all the episodes. So I will work with a director on a film and an executive producer on a TV show, but I work as closely as they are able to work with me. I love the process of collaboration, and I love getting inside a creative person's head and trying to extract from my own creativity what it is that they have originally in mind. And there's something very wonderful in the symbiosis that takes place, where the director can get to the point where he can direct me, which is really wonderful because I get to then do things that I might not have been necessarily inclined to do in the first place. It allows me to discover things about my own creativity that I always look forward to.
So how did you come to work on the TV series Earth 2?
Earth 2, actually, I got to work on through a lady called Roxane Lepel, who was the head of music for Universal at the time, and who'd introduced me to the executive producer of the show called Michael Duggan. We'd worked together on a couple of movies of the week at the time for Universal, and I'd heard through by just being in meetings and such that they were working on this sci-fi project. So I actually spent a long week coming up with a very interesting music montage, like a presentation, a collage of ideas of what I felt the sound could be for that particular series, and called them and asked them to him and actually Tony Toe and a few other of the producers on the film, on the project, and sat them down and played them a montage of ideas, and that's how I came to work on it.
Okay. So now, did you treat the music on Earth 2 any differently than you would on a regular drama?
I think that there's a need. It goes back to the first question you asked me, or an earlier question you asked me. I tried to give a unique color to every single project. Mm-hmm. It's really important to me that each score has have a different flavor, let's say. Maybe to use a cooking analogy, I try to use different spices in each of my dishes. So the thing that's maybe a little bit more unique about sci-fi is that it, more so than, say, an urban project, it needs to have a certain sense of timelessness. So there's some restrictions as to the ability to use more contemporary sound that might become more dated quicker. Mm-hmm. It's nice to see a sci-fi movie 20 years later and not necessarily go, ooh, that's a 1970s keyboard. You know, so it restricts sometimes the choices of in a desire to make it even more timeless, a little bit like a romantic movie. I feel the same way about.
So how much time were you given to score an individual episode?
Anywhere from 3 weeks to down to 1 week towards the end. In TV, often the last few episodes of a season are in a what we call accelerated schedule where things get crunched. So I think the least I ever had was, I don't think we ever had less than 1 week, but probably never more than three.
Okay. Now, you've mentioned color on a few occasions. Were you given a chance on Earth 2 to experiment with different kinds of instruments and adding different colors to the score?
Well, that was actually part of my original pitch to Michael and, mm-hmm. and the other producers, was that because of the concept of the show, which was that these settlers were crashing on this kind of old Earth planet, Earth-like planet, mm-hmm. Which was inhabited by strange creatures, I wanted to create some interesting textures and colors without using synthesizers, because they were abandoned with no technology on this archaic world. Mm-hmm. And the original pitch that I made was to try to create instruments, acoustic instruments, that would maybe be our you know, strange colors. Sci-fi obviously calls for a lot of strange colors and strange textures. It's an artificial, strange world, so we want to say this musically as well, but I didn't want to use synthesizers to do it. So I went on a long search of instrument makers and collected some, had some instruments made for the show, collected some instruments that were at the time not necessarily altogether too popular in our music, like ney. Let's say I picked up a ney for the solo wind instrument. It's an Arabic flute, which at the time hadn't been heard too much. Since then, Peter Gabriel has made much use of it, but at the time it was an interesting color for the wind for me, and that was what I equated with. I had some giant 40-foot pieces of bamboo shipped from the South Pacific and made this big bass didgeridoo to have more of the lower rumbles. And so, yeah, we created a lot of things for the show, and many of which I still have laying around the house. Actually, they're fun instruments and make great conversation pieces.
Right. So how do you find players for these instruments?
That was interesting. Actually, I there were a couple of instrumentalists in town. For one thing, I ended up learning how to play many of them, just for mm-hmm. kicks, and just because it was interesting to see what was playable or not on some of them. And some of them I had designed myself, so I had to make sure that they were playable.
Right.
And it was actually a long process. We started doing this, I think I spent a good 4 months of just prepping things and flying around and meeting instrument makers and having them make stuff and trying it out. So I was blowing through some of them, and later when the show, and in some of the later episodes, actually, I played a lot of the instruments myself because it was fun and interesting. But for the live session, because we recorded a lot of the strange instruments with the orchestra for the pilot, I had a few woodwind players and percussionists. I gave them the instruments that I had collected, and I gave them instructions, and they were kind enough to go home and actually learn how to play them. One of whom became a very dear friend who has played since then on pretty much all of my scores, called Fred Selden. Los Angeles musicians are quite marvelous at learning strange 40-foot bamboo pieces.
Well, now, unfortunately, Earth 2 did not last past its first season. Now, were you able to, as in creating the color for the series, were you able to create or at least start to create themes for specific characters, or do you do that?
Yeah, it depends. There's some projects where I try to come up with themes for, you know, each mood. It's a stylistic choice whether to create character-driven thematic motifs, and it works in some movies, mm-hmm. and there are other movies where it's just going to be a la Star Wars, you know, where you have the Darth Vader theme and
mm-hmm.
the Luke Skywalker theme. Is it going to be one of those kind of scores, or is it going to be more like a John Barry score where you have an overall mood and impression, like Out of Africa? And it's a stylistic choice that governs, that is at the beginning. We did that ahead of time. Now, in the case of Earth 2, it was fun because we had so many cool, colorful characters, and we, you know, conceivably we're going to have years of this TV show. So we wanted to milk it for what it was worth. So, yes, I got to write some things, even for the Tim Curry character, who only came in towards the end, and we thought we're going to be a more central character in later seasons. But the Grendlers, who were just kind of funny, round, bobbly creatures, had their own sound. The Tarians, who were the central life form from the planet, had their own sound. Even the kids had their own sound. So, yeah, we got to play around with it.
Okay.